This program is provided by lawyer Kyung Jin Kim.
So picture a perfectly ordinary bedroom in a graduate student's parents' house. The year is 2012.
Right, just a typical student setup.
Exactly. It's the kind of room you'd expect a busy computer science student to live in. You know, desk totally cluttered with research papers, empty coffee mugs everywhere. But if you were to walk into this room, the very first thing you'd notice is the sound.
Oh, yeah. That sound.
It's this really aggressive, constant, just high-pitched whirring. And the heat, I mean, it is uncomfortably, almost oppressively warm in there.
Because sitting on that desk is a computer running two gaming graphics cards. And it'd be GTX 580s, right?
Yep, GTX 580s. And they are running at absolute maximum capacity, just pushing their cooling fans to the absolute physical limit.
Only they aren't actually rendering graphics for a video game. I mean, there's no digital dragons on the screen, no spaceships, no high-resolution textures.
No, not at all. Those two graphics cards are running complex math. Math that is quietly and invisibly about to completely shock the entire world.
They're training an artificial intelligence network, right?
Exactly, a network called AlexNet. And in doing so, they're literally kickstarting the AI revolution that, well, that you and I are living through right now. So today's deep dive is all about how we got into that exact bedroom.
It's such a fascinating history.
It really is. We are exploring the story of Jensen Huang, leaning into some incredible insights from his biography, Caesar of Silicon. Specifically, we're looking at the period that's often called his 10 years of solitary investment.
10 very long, very expensive years.
Seriously. Our mission today is to uncover that agonizing, incredibly lonely 10-year gamble that essentially made our modern AI era possible. It's a story about, you know, what happens when you bet literally everything your company has on a future that absolutely nobody else can see.
It is a remarkable narrative of endurance. I mean, to really grasp the magic of what was happening in that Toronto bedroom in 2012, we actually have to rewind the clock quite a bit, back to the year 2006.
Okay, 2006. Set the stage for us.
So this was Jensen Huang's true Rubicon moment. It's a historical parallel to Julius Caesar crossing the Rubicon River, where even Caesar's own loyal soldiers didn't really fully grasp the magnitude of the decision they were making, right? They just looked ahead and saw cold water and darkness.
Wow. Okay. Because in 2006, NVIDIA was, what, basically standing on top of the world?
Exactly. They were the undisputed king of video game graphics. They had this incredibly clear, highly profitable, heavily paved road ahead of them. The directive was simple. Just make more beautiful graphics, faster frame rates, and sell to more gamers.
Right. It's the classic business playbook. You dominate a market, and you do not rock the boat. You just optimize the supply chain, keep your head down, and count the profits.
But Huang was looking past the explosions and the shadows on the computer screen. He was looking at a completely new frontier general computing. He basically recognized this massive storm on the horizon that the rest of the industry was, well, largely just ignoring.
Because the traditional way computers processed information was hitting a very real physical wall, wasn't it?
Yeah, Moore's Law, that golden rule that computer processing power would double every 18 months or so, it was finally slowing down.
I actually want to pause there for a second because, you know, we hear Moore's Law thrown around a lot, but the physics behind why it was failing is so crucial here. For decades, chip makers like Intel were just shrinking transistors down. You make the transistor smaller, you fit more of them on a CPU, and boom, the processor goes faster.
Simple enough, right?
Right, but by 2006, they were shrinking these things down to the atomic level.
Which introduces massive, massive physical problems. When transistors get that microscopically small, you start dealing with quantum tunneling.
Where the electrons just literally leak through the barrier.
Exactly. And even more importantly, you generate an uncontrollable amount of heat. You couldn't just keep cranking up the clock speed of a single core CPU anymore without...
Without it literally melting the motherboard.
Right. Intel and AMD were hitting a strict thermal limit.
So the era of the single superfast processor was basically dead. The industry knew they had to find another way. But why would a graphics card company care? To understand the leap Huang was envisioning, you really have to look at the architectural difference between the two brains inside a computer.
The CPU versus the GPU.
Exactly. So first you have the CPU. Think of the CPU as like the high school class president. Incredibly smart, well-rounded, good at writing, good at calculating, good at everything. But the class president can only do one complex task at a time. It is inherently sequential. Step one, then step two, then step three.
Which is a huge structural bottleneck if you were trying to process massive, massive data sets.
Totally. Then on the other hand, you have the GPU. The graphics chip. Think of the GPU as 10,000 extremely fast art students.
I love this analogy.
So good, right? They are writing brilliant essays. They are actually very simple. But if you need millions of pixels painted on a screen simultaneously, like to render a shadow moving across a wall in a video game, these 10,000 art students will all paint their one assigned pixel in a fraction of a second. They work in parallel.
And this is exactly where Huang's vision crystallized. He looked at those 10,000 art students and asked a really profound architectural question. What if we could get them to stop painting pixels and start solving complex math problems instead?
Right.
If we have thousands of workers operating simultaneously, wouldn't that just completely shatter the speed limits of the traditional single-minded CPU?
Okay, but I have to push back on the mechanics of that. Because art students are great at painting simultaneously because painting a shadow is an independent task, right? Pixel A doesn't really need to know what Pixel B is doing.
But general math-like scientific computing is often sequential. Step two fundamentally depends on the answer to step one. You can't just, tell 10,000 specialized artists to go solve a fluid dynamics equation. They don't speak the language of general math.
And that is the fundamental computer science hurdle they faced. You needed a translator, a way to take traditional sequential code and farm it out to thousands of parallel workers. And that translator was a new software platform that Huang decided to just build from scratch.
This is CUDA.
Yes, CUDA, Compute Unified Device Architecture. What CUD did was revolutionary on a software engineering level.
Yeah.
It used the familiar C programming language.
Which is the foundational language that software engineers already knew and used every single day.
Exactly. Mm. CUDA acted as this deep-level interpreter. It allowed programmers to write standard, non-graphics instructions, and the CUDA software would automatically figure out how to break that math down into thousands of independent threads.
Wow.
Yeah, translating them so those GPU art students could actually understand and execute them all simultaneously.
So it's unlocking this massive reservoir of computing power that was just, sitting there, trapped entirely in the realm of video games. Suddenly you could use a graphics card for general calculations.
The theory was absolutely brilliant, but the execution, the market viewed it as financial suicide.
Really? Why?
Well, Jensen Huang didn't just release CUDA as an optional software package for a few niche enterprise clients. He made a sweeping, absolute decree. CUDA would be integrated into every single NVIDIA chip moving forward.
Oh, wow. Every single one.
Every single one. Whether it was a $5,000 high-end card for a professional video editor or a $50 cheap card for a teenager playing games in their basement, it was going to have the CUDA architecture physically built right into the silicon.
Oh, man. Adding features to silicon is incredibly punishing from a manufacturing standpoint. I mean, every time you add a new capability to a semiconductor, the physical size of the die, the actual chip itself, has to increase to fit the new transistors.
And wafer economics are just unforgiving. Semiconductor chips are printed on circular silicon wafers. If you make the individual chip bigger, you fit fewer of them on a single wafer.
Which immediately slashes your profit margins.
Instantly. Furthermore, a larger surface area means a higher statistical chance that just a microscopic speck of dust ruins the chip during manufacturing.
Yeah.
Your yield rates absolutely plummet.
Plus, the chips generate far more heat and they consume significantly more electricity. So if I'm a gamer in 2007, and let's be real, that's the core demographic keeping the company afloat at the time, I am furious.
Oh, you were.
I'm suddenly paying more money for a graphics card that runs hotter, draws more power from my wall, and sounds like a jet engine, all because it has some, scientific calculation feature etched into the silicon that I will literally never, ever use. I just want my game to run at 60 frames per second. I don't want to calculate molecular structures.
Yeah, the consumer base was super confused and frustrated. But Wall Street's reaction? That was something closer to sheer unadulterated rage.
I can only imagine.
The financial toll this took on the company is staggering to review. Between 2006 and 2017, NVIDIA poured approximately $12 billion into research and development.
$12 billion, which, is over 15 trillion Korean won for perspective. That is an unbelievable amount of money.
Right. And by 2014, more than 30% of their total revenue was vanishing straight into R&D, largely just to build and maintain this massive CUDA software ecosystem and support the bloated silicon.
30% of gross revenue evaporating into R&D, that is an unbelievable burn rate for a publicly traded company. I mean, most boards of directors would fire a CEO immediately for that kind of reckless spending on an unproven market.
Investors were literally screaming at him on earnings calls. They were asking the obvious questions. Who is using this? Where is the market? Show us the return on this $12 billion investment.
And what was the answer?
For a very long time, the answer was basically nobody. During the 2008 financial crisis, NVIDIA's stock plummeted by over 80% from its peak. Financial analysts were writing these scathing reports, officially valuing the entire CUDA ecosystem at exactly $0.
$0.
Yep. They categorized it as a massive cost center with zero proven revenue. For years, stretching from 2009 all the way to 2015, the company's market cap just stagnated in the mud.
It's not even just building a highway in the desert. It's like spending your life savings to build a highly specialized magnetic levitation track in the middle of a barren desert, hoping someone eventually invents a maglev train to drive on it. All while your current customers are yelling at you to just pave their driveway, everyone driving past just sees a guy burning money in the sand.
That's a perfect way to put it. But he persisted. He pushed through that agonizing decade because of a deeply held business philosophy that completely flies in the face of traditional MBA logic.
Mm-hmm.
He called it the strategy of the $0 billion market.
Okay, the $0 billion market. Explain that.
So traditional business wisdom dictates that you find a market with high existing demand, right? And you build a product to capture a share of that demand.
Yeah.
Huang argued the exact opposite. He believed that if you build where there are zero customers today, you'll face zero competitors tomorrow.
Wow. We don't fight for market share, we create the market. It is an incredibly bold, borderline arrogant stance to take.
It takes a lot of nerve.
But wait, if gamers didn't care about CDA and Wall Street was panicked and valuing this technology at $0, who was actually driving on this desert maglev track? The first early adopters couldn't have been massive tech conglomerates or Fortune 500 companies.
No, not at all. They were impoverished, underdog academic scientists.
Really? Scientists?
Yeah. The scientific research landscape at the time was facing a severe, severe bottleneck. Imagine you're a researcher trying to model complex genetics, or predict long-term global weather patterns, or simulate molecular dynamics for drug discovery.
Heavy stuff.
To do that, you need to process an astronomical number of variables interacting with each other simultaneously. Doing that on a standard CPU-based computer would take months, assuming it even finished at all without crashing.
You essentially needed a supercomputer.
Yep. Exactly. But supercomputers are exceedingly rare. They cost tens, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars to build. They belong to national governments or the military. If you were just a university researcher with a modest grant, you had to submit a formal application to a national supercomputer center and wait.
Oh, the bureaucracy.
It was terrible. Sometimes you'd wait 6 months for just a tiny 24-hour window of access. And if your research wasn't considered, you know, mainstream or top priority, you might never get approved at all.
So you're completely at the mercy of bureaucratic gatekeepers. Your entire life's work is just stalled in a queue.
So NVIDIA initiated this brilliant grassroots campaign. They started essentially giving away these cheap gaming GPUs, or at least selling them at a really steep discount, to universities and research labs around the world. And they gave away the CUDA software development kit for free.
Wait, okay. So suddenly, a grad student could just go down to the local electronics market, buy a standard gaming card for $300, stick it under their desk, install CUDA,
and have a desktop machine that actually rivaled the processing power of a national supercomputer from just a few years prior.
That's insane! But we have to look at the dual nature of this strategy, because this wasn't just corporate charity, right? By giving the hardware away and actively teaching CDA programming in over 200 universities worldwide, NVIDIA was building an inescapable generational moat.
Precisely.
They were locking the smartest scientific minds on Earth into their proprietary ecosystem. Because once a PhD student spends 4 years writing their physics simulation in CDA, they can't just easily switch to a competitor's chip later on. They would have to rewrite hundreds of thousands of lines of code from scratch.
It is the textbook definition of a defensive moat. And it was built quietly in the academic underground, while competitors like Intel and AMD were completely asleep at the wheel, arguing over minor technical specs on gaming processors. There is an incredibly touching anecdote from this era that really gets to the emotional core of what NVIDIA was enabling. A quantum chemist actually approached Jensen Huang at a conference. He explained that because of this cheap GPU and the free CUDA platform, he would finally be able to finish his life's work within his own lifetime.
Rather than passing incomplete simulations onto the next generation, that is profound. You are literally giving someone their life back.
Yeah. Huang later reflected on that specific interaction, saying, if that doesn't move you, you're a corpse.
Yeah.
He framed their entire mission around a very specific concept. We didn't give them microscopes. We made them into telescopes.
I absolutely love that distinction. A microscope just lets you look closer at the exact same problems you already know about. A telescope gives you the vision to look out and discover entirely new galaxies of possibility that you didn't even know existed.
Beautifully said.
And all of those university experiments, all those brilliant scientists hacking away in the dark on cheap gaming cards, they were quietly laying the invisible groundwork for the massive explosion that brings us right back to the messy bedroom from our opening scene.
Right. The spark that finally lit the powder keg. It's 2012. We're at the University of Toronto. Two students, Alex Krzyzewski and Ilya Sutskever, who are studying under the legendary computer scientist Geoffrey Hinton, enter an artificial intelligence competition called ImageNet.
Okay, ImageNet. The challenge was simple but historically impossible, right? Build a software system that could correctly identify objects in a massive data set of photographs.
Up until this point, progress in computer vision was agonizingly slow. It relied on humans manually coding rules, telling the computer to look for edges or specific colors.
Mm.
Progress was measured in tiny, tiny fractions of a percent, like first place might beat second place by 0.5%.
Very incremental.
But Alex and Ilya took a radically different approach. They used deep neural networks, which fundamentally mimic the human brain. But neural networks require a staggering amount of parallel mathematical calculations. They're essentially just giant spreadsheets of matrix multiplication.
Doing that on traditional CPUs would take years.
Exactly. So they used CUDA, they used those two GTX 580 gaming cards, whirring away in their bedroom to train an AI model they called AlexNet. They accomplished with two cheap graphics cards what previously would have required thousands of CPUs clustered together.
Unbelievable.
And when the ImageNet results came in, they didn't just win. They completely shattered the paradigm. They dropped the error rate from 26% all the way down to 15%, a sheer cliff drop leap of over 10% in a single year.
In the world of computer science, breaking a benchmark by 10% is like breaking the sound barrier. It proves the physics of the universe have shifted.
Pioneers in the field immediately recognized it as the clear turning point in the history of artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
And Jensen Huang's reaction to this bedroom experiment was absolute. He looked at the AlexNet results, looked at the underlying math, and declared, "This is it, the moment we've been waiting for."
Yeah.
He immediately pivoted the entire weight, capital, and engineering force of the corporation. His message to the company was clear and uncompromising. We are no longer a graphics company. We are an AI company.
Just like that, the maglev track in the desert was finally built, and suddenly the first massive convoy of futuristic trains appeared on the horizon. Which actually brings us to a wildly ironic milestone. Fast forward 4 years to 2016.
Okay, 2016.
NVIDIA decides they need to build custom hardware specifically for this new AI market. They unveiled the DGX-1. This is the world's first AI-in-a-box supercomputer. It links 8 massive GPUs together, offering 170 teraflops of computing power.
To put 170 teraflops into perspective, that means the machine could perform 170 trillion floating-point mathematical operations every single second.
It was an absolute monster of computation, and it came with a massive price tag of $129,000.
A total engineering marvel. And yet the public reception from the tech industry was shockingly detached.
Right. Huang unveils this $129,000 AI supercomputer at the massive GTC developer conference, fully expecting awe, and the reaction from the crowd, dead silence.
Crickets.
No applause, just total blank confusion. Someone in the audience actually raised their hand, looked at this machine capable of altering human history, and asked, "Does it run Windows?"
That perfectly highlights how, even as late as 2016, the broader tech and financial worlds still didn't fully comprehend the tsunami that was gathering just off the coast. They were still trapped in the old paradigm of desktop operating systems and word processors.
Completely missing the point.
But there was one very specific group that understood exactly what the DGX-1 represented.
A tiny nonprofit startup operating out of an office in San Francisco.
OpenAI. At the time, they were just a small, relatively unknown research lab led by Elon Musk and Sam Altman. but they were desperately trying to scale up neural networks, and they knew they were bottlenecked by hardware. They wanted that machine more than anything.
The imagery of how they actually got it is fantastic. Jensen Huang didn't just box it up and ship it via standard freight. He personally loaded the very first DGX-1 into the trunk of his car and drove it across the bay to the OpenAI office.
He joked that he was just a highly overpaid DoorDash delivery guy.
Yes. He personally hauled this monumental piece of hardware inside and handed it over to Elon Musk and Sam Altman.
And that specific machine, that exact physical piece of hardware, is what OpenAI used to train the early rudimentary language models. Mm-hmm. Is the direct ancestor, the foundational bedrock of the massive ChatGPT models that are fundamentally reshaping our global economy and society today.
It is wild to trace that causality chain backward. I mean, a deeply unpopular, incredibly expensive decision made in 2006 to force a mathematical translator into a video game chip directly leads to a CEO hand-delivering a supercomputer out of his trunk in 2016, which then officially births the modern AI revolution.
If we synthesize this grand narrative, the ultimate takeaway is pretty striking. NVIDIA's absolute near-monopolistic dominance in the AI hardware space today wasn't a lucky pivot. It wasn't an overnight success. It was 30 years of grueling engineering in the making.
Yeah.
And that specific 10-year period, the agonizing decade of CEDA, wasn't just about surviving a rough patch in the stock market. It was the seed growing a massive, complex, inescapable root system underground in the absolute dark. Huh. Wall Street analysts looked at the dirt, saw no green shoots, and valued it at zero.
But underneath the soil, a legion of scientists, researchers, and underdog students were actively building the computational infrastructure of the 21st century.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? As you process this deep dive, think about Jensen Huang's own reflection on surviving that era. He noted that greatness is not merely a matter of extreme intellect or talent, but rather a character that has the capacity to endure extended suffering.
Endure extended suffering. That's powerful.
Think about that in the context of your own life, your career, or your creative projects. When you are building something you deeply believe in, something you know mechanically is necessary for the future, but the entire world, your bosses, the market, your peers, looks at it and values it at exactly $0. Remember the 10-year desert. Remember the decade of solitary investment. True innovation rarely looks like a quick celebrated win. It almost always looks like an extended period of being entirely misunderstood.
This raises a critical question, and is really the thought I want to leave you pondering today. We have just explored how one man's stubborn refusal to abandon a useless $0 billion market ultimately built the hardware that dictates our entire future in artificial intelligence. So look around at the technological landscape today. What other useless technologies currently being mocked by Wall Street or completely ignored by the mainstream press as a waste of time are quietly, in the dark, laying the absolute foundations for the next century of human history?
A fascinating question to carry with you. Keep looking out for those hidden roots. Until next time.
This program is provided by Lawyer Kyungjin Kim.